Our final speaker for the evening, Cornel West, is probably the nation's most prominent public intellectual today, and therefore needs only a very brief introduction. He's a professor of religion and African American studies at Harvard, the author of numerous books, including the best-selling Race Matters, and more important than those honors, I think, a voice of reason, compassion, and morality for all Americans in these troubled times. So it's a great honor to introduce Cornel West.
Thank you so very much. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you so very much, indeed. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Appreciate it. Appreciate it. No, indeed. Indeed, I know it's getting late. I promise not to be too long, but this is a historic event. This is a propitious moment in the history of this country. I'd like to thank my friend and brother and comrade, Eric Foner, who's the finest American historian of his generation. He's never lost sight. Working people.
Very much so. Very much so.
I'd like to thank the young people who will be gathering here Saturday in Hamilton Hall to keep alive this tradition of struggle all day Saturday, sponsored by DSA, trying to accent what we're doing on the ground for a younger generation. And last but not least, I'd like to thank that group that made September 13th an upbeat day for me, even given the death of Brother Tupac Shakur. When I got up that morning, I said, this is the anniversary of the uprising of Attica State Prison. That there's something going on in these prisons, even given these moments in which we often forget or downplay. But lo and behold, there was that local 2110 that was winning a victory, and I said, there's still some signs of hope, even on Friday the 13th. And I want to thank y'all for that. I want to thank y'all for that. Because we've come here tonight to attempt to energize and galvanize a tradition. It's a tradition of struggle. Of struggle for decency and dignity, of struggle for freedom and democracy. There's wind at our backs, even in this dark and difficult time. Let us never forget that. It's a tradition that has the audacity to say we still will wrestle with the most fundamental question of what it means to be human, namely the problem of evil. How will we respond to unjustified suffering and unwarranted pain and undeserved harm and unnecessary misery? And we say there's still too much suffering. There's still too much harm. There's still too much misery. There's still too much pain in America and around the world. And it's difficult for fellow citizens and fellow human beings to take us seriously, because we are the audacious, radical Democrats that say we know we live at the end of a ghastly century. We haven't forgotten the 200 million who have been murdered in the name of some pernicious ideology. We'll never forget the Nazism at the heart of so-called civilized Europe and the Stalinism at the core of so-called emancipatory Soviet Union. We'll never forget that European colonialism and imperialism that has left such scars and bruises in Asia and Africa. We won't forget the patriarchy that's left such bruises on sisters in our social system. We won't forget the homophobia that's closeted so many gay brothers and lesbian sisters. But here we stand at the end of this century and say we are going to keep the radical democratic tradition alive, come what may. We're going to keep it alive, which means that we're going to love and respect our fellow citizens and fellow human beings enough to tell them the truth about their situation. We will tell them that unregulated, unedited, and unfettered capitalism is killing us. It's killing us. will tell them that the vicious legacy of white supremacy is still alive. It's suffocating us. Pernicious practice of male supremacy is still at work. It's stifling us. The invidious ideology of homophobia is crippling us. And this is not cheap PC. This is no cheap PC. Let's tell our conservative fellow citizens that we're talking about what the great artists have always talked about. We're talking about what the great Eugene O'Neill connected to, that rich Irish tradition of struggle that Brother John Sweeney is part of. The great John Sweeney at this point. And it's true that he is where he is for a special reason at this point in American history. And in 1946, when the greatest American playwright returned from California after 12 years of silence with his new play, The Ice Man Cometh, Eugene O'Neill told the press he was short with words like John Coltrane, but he spoke through his art. Didn't like to talk to the press too much. He said, what is the play about? He says, it's about one question. What does it profit a nation to conquer the world and lose its soul? And the Iceman has been at work in America in the last 25 years. These have been icy times in this country. And yet, we still persist. We recognize that we are at the crossroads, the fork in the road, in the history of this very precious yet precarious experiment in democracy. We could well be witnessing the embryonic stages of the disintegration and dissolution and decomposition of American civilization. That is a real possibility. Civilizations wax and wane, they come and go. There's no guarantee that America will make it into the 21st century with its radical democratic tradition alive unless we do something about it. No guarantee. And this particular moment is the most frightening and terrifying moments in the history of this country. There's no external enemy to unite the people that hides and conceals their own suffering and misery. No communists. We're forced to look at ourselves. There's very few who want to speak candidly about the relative economic decline in this nation. Who wants to begin with the slow motion depression, the silent depression that has been ravaging Chocolate City since 1973. The levels of unemployment and underemployment not reflected in the labor statistics of the State Department, who do not count part-time workers looking for full-time jobs, or those who give it up looking for jobs. You don't want to talk about the dilapidated housing and the decrepit school systems that break the motivational structures of so many young brothers and sisters of all colors. Don't want to talk about the inadequate health care and the unavailable child care, and yet we hear over and over again the economy is stronger now than it's been in 30 years. Who are you talking about? The top 20%, yes. The top 1%, euphoric. One out of five of brothers and sisters of all colors in the labor force work more than 40 hours a week, do not receive one penny from the federal government, and still live in poverty, still growing every day. And yet 1% of the population own 36% of the household wealth. 99% of the wealth accrued to that 1% between 1983 and 1989. The statistics, as was put forward in the wonderful text by Brother Sweeney, 205% increase in corporate profits since 1980. 499% increase in the salaries of CEOs, and yet 25% of all of America's children live in poverty, and 42% of brown brothers and sisters live in poverty, and 51% of black brothers and sisters live in poverty in a nation predicated on a promise that the future would always be better. Something is wrong in America. Talk about democracy, but it's really oligarchic, plutocratic, to some degree, pigmentocratic when we talk about the economy. And don't let anybody tell you that simply because the American economy is still oligocratic and plutocratic and pigmentocratic that one is some kind of communist, a truncated socialist. You're simply a Democrat trying to make sense of why there's so much suffering in the world, that's all. You know that political rights and liberties are preconditions for democracy. You know America would not have its political rights and liberties if it were not for working people who organized and mobilized and made them real on the ground. We know the social structure that once looked like a diamond is beginning to look more and more like a pyramid. It creates depths of economic insecurity and anxiety, and it makes persons feel as if things are out of control. And it's human, all too human, to feel when things are out of control, to want to scapegoat the most vulnerable because of the cowardly streak in all of us. We want to look down to the powerless rather than look up to the powerful. We can focus on the immigrants, especially brown immigrants, and say, oh, just keep them out and things will be intact. So how long you been here? I'm third generation. I'm glad great-grandma got in, but we're closing things up now. We can target the sisters of all colors, push them back in the kitchen. They're in the labor force making things difficult for the brothers. They can't be manly. They can't pose in posture and act as if they're lions of the family, king of the house. Or maybe it's those gay brothers and lesbian sisters, you know, that 3.5-4% who stepped out of the closet and the whole civilization began to decline. Oh, it's those black folk. They're the ones. The 244 years of chattel slavery, 81 years of Jim and Jane Crow, 51 years and every 2.5 days some black child, a black woman, a black man was hanging from some tree, that strange fruit the southern trees bear that Billie Holiday sang about. And we finally break the back of American apartheid and just begin to get not a foothold but a toehold into the so-called mainstream. And yet targeted as making special pleas, excessive demands. Black folk taking over. I was talking to some reactionary white brothers the other day. Black folk taking over, they responsible for me losing my job. I said, well, how many black folk own production units in your town? Well, none that I know of. Okay. Oh, I understand. Think you need a more complex analysis, brother. I'm sorry you don't have a job. Even given your reactionary politics, you still a human being. I know you suffer too. He said, no, it's that affirmative action that did it. I said, oh. How many black folk in your workplace? It's 4 out of 80. Oh, they taking over, aren't they? Oh, that affirmative action. That's something else. I bet you they all in senior management, huh? Yeah, uh-huh. But of course, he is searching too, trying to make sense of his pain. And we can't leave those brothers and sisters to rush limbo. There's some way we got to create a bridge for those folk. How do we broaden their vision and analysis? That's the challenge. And we do that by being candid about our own history. A revitalized labor movement is the prerequisite for rejuvenated social motion and momentum in this country. But at the same time, let us not fetishize the labor movement and ascribe these magical powers to it as if we just waiting for them to descend from heaven. They're made up of fellow human beings too. And they have to struggle with the same forces in the larger society within their own ranks. It's just that they happen to be a group of Americans who tilt in a radical democratic direction to the degree to which they know that their relative powerlessness at the workplace means that they're unable to be able to live lives of decency and dignity without being organized and mobilized and bring power and pressure to bear against management. None of us will be able to actually walk and talk and actually feel as if we're part of a society that's worth being a part of. Which is to say that the revitalized labor movement is a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition for the fundamental transformation of American society. Very important. And it's here where we must wrestle with the deep cultural crisis. It's very real, and it cuts across ideological and political lines. We're living in a society in which we're witnessing the relative erosion of the systems of caring and nurturing. More and more shattered families and neighborhoods. Neighborhoods becoming hoods now. Weakening civil institutions. Making it difficult for all of us, but especially young people, to gain access to the very preconditions of what it is to be human in part, namely those bonds of affection and affirmation of people who care for you and love you and nurture you and give you a sense of possibility and self-confidence, those networks of support and those ties of empathy and bonds of sympathy. And the labor movement, in this sense, becomes more than simply an economic institution concerned with class struggle at the workplace, as important as it is. It's also a cultural space with people who care about you, people who can bring the best out of you. And how rare it is in America, given the fact that we are more racially segregated now than we were in 1965, even given the overcoming of legal segregation, that there's a public space where we can enter without humiliation, that we can engage in give and take and argument, mediate it with some respect rather than that ugly name calling and finger pointing that constitutes so much public conversation these days. What public spaces do we actually have in which we don't have to deny, but at the same time we can transcend our racial and gender and sexual orientational identities? Where we're not just clients of a constituency, but we're actually citizens in the making. And by citizens, I mean public actors. Focus on public interest to generate new public action and respond to public problems. Which is to say, be able to bring together persons, different cultures and heritages. Not in order to celebrate us at some kind of ethnic smorgasbord-like picnic, to focus on something bigger than them. Something bigger than them that accents the best in them, namely the democratic identity, the radical democratic identity. How crucial. Great John Dewey of this institution in his classic of 1927, The Public and Its Problems, he said, show me a democracy that proliferates publics and constituencies and identities, but does not have a democratic public wherein they can enter in order to focus as radical Democrats on problems that affect all citizens. Show me a democracy that cannot engage in high quality public conversation about those public problems, and I'll show you a democracy sliding down the slope to chaos and anarchy. That's John Dewey in 1927. And it still resonates so deep in 1996. And let us never forget that the ultimate logic of unfettered capitalist forces is the creation of a market culture that becomes so obsessed with buying and selling and promoting and advertising that market mentalities become hegemonic. Hedonism, narcissism, I want pleasure now. I want power now. I want property now. Your property, I got a little technology too. I'm saying in part that the ultimate logic of unfettered capitalist forces creating a market culture is the gangsterization of culture, in which people feel as if they will attempt to get over by any means. And gangsterization of culture may be reflected and refracted in part in so-called gangster rap. But we know that there's gangster mentality shot through every institution in this society, from White House to State House to City Hall to church, mosque, synagogue, educational institution, and so on. And the only countervailing forces against gangsterization on a local, regional, national, a global level are democratic practices and procedures. Countervailing forces that attempt to render elites accountable. Democracies are very rare in human history. They tend not to last too long. America's oldest surviving democracy. And for many people, it seemed as if it may be running out of gas. And we look back at those few experiments in democracy. We see two fatal viruses sitting at the center: poverty and paranoia. Increasing poverty generating escalating levels of despair. There will never be enough prisons and police to deal with a grand avalanche of despair. And paranoia, that increasing paranoia generating escalating levels of distrust. And no democracy can survive with pervasive distrust. It creates a culture of cynicism. We think it's clever to avoid humiliation, and therefore we identify with aggression and downplay sympathy and connection. Cynicism, fatalism, pessimism, addiction, addictive personalities, strategies for survival in a market culture, but taking us away from this tradition, this radical democratic tradition of struggle. We are here to say tonight that first and foremost, we will attempt to reconstitute this grand tradition by beginning with something profoundly un-American, a sense of history. A deep sense of history. We will highlight non-market values in a market culture. Non-market values like love and care and concern and service to others. Non-market values like solidarity and community and fidelity and loyalty. Even on the interpersonal dimension, which must not be overlooked, because we must deal with one another and we will have disagreements. But non-market values like gentleness and kindness and sweetness and tenderness that makes so much of life worth living. We say that we will attempt to be courageous. Not simply a matter of standing up for our convictions, but also having the courage to attack our convictions. Sometimes we could be wrong. We're Democrats. We could be wrong. We'll listen to one another. We'll push one another. We'll unsettle one another for a greater good. And more than anything else at this moment, we'll attempt to project a sense of hope. And by hope, I do not mean optimism. I do not think at the moment that there's enough evidence that will allow us to infer that we can win. Not at all. We must cut against the grain. And hope looks at the underdetermined evidence, the flimsy evidence, and says, we will make a leap of democratic faith beyond it. We'll believe enough in each other to acknowledge that even if our numbers at the moment are small, by witness, by discipline, by struggle, we will exemplify this democratic tradition in such a way that it might become contagious. It might provide analysis of why you're in such pain. It might provide a way out, some vision, as it were. Somewhere I read, where there is no vision, the people perish. And people are perishing. And vision is not a vision thing, as a fellow citizen who lives in Texas, George Bush, said. It's the power. Convince persons that they could do things when they had concluded that they could not. That's the fundamental challenge. Let us go henceforth with our sense of history, expanding our non-market values in a courageous manner, self-critical, self-corrective, and with a sense of hope. Acknowledging there may be limits, but we know not of. That we can laugh at ourselves and our own contradictions and still keeping on. Let us keep our heads not so much on the ground, but to the sky, as Earth, Wind, and Fire would put it. Let's keep our hands on the plow, the way Mahalia Jackson used to sing with such power and poignancy. And let us keep our eyes not so much on each other's inadequacies, but on the prize, something bigger than us and grander than us that can appeal to the better angels of our nature. And maybe then we can meet the challenge. But whether we can or not, let us all go down fighting. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you, Cornel West, and all the other speakers. To those here, those in the overflow rooms behind me and in Skirmerhorn and outside, thank you for coming tonight. And let me just remind you that starting at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning in Altschul Auditorium of the School of International Affairs building with another plenary session and then a whole series of smaller workshops and discussions on the issues discussed tonight. We will spend all day tomorrow considering these issues and how we can move forward from here. So thanks for coming and good night. And thank you to the program again.